Well, good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium. I'm the Executive Director, Nigella Hillgarth. And it's a great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Ralph Keeling. I would like to start off by letting you know that Ralph is not only the son of a very distinguished scientist that many of you know, Charles David Keeling, but he's a very distinguished atmospheric scientist in his own right. And in fact, he has really been a scientist from a very young age, and I have to tell you a very short story about him. I gathered he was hiking in the Cascades one summer when he was 2 years old with his family, and they were looking at the Nisqually Glacier, and suddenly this little voice pipes up, "How do you make glaciers?" H2. So not only was he interested in science then, but his command of the English language was clearly incredible. And of course he had to do a little formal training, so he went to Yale to do his bachelor's, and then he went to Harvard to do his PhD, which was slightly more theory than practical work. And then he became very interested in the really intricate measurements of atmospheric gases, particularly measuring oxygen in the atmosphere. And so I think that this really, he's now taken on, as I said, the mantle of his father. He is now the current director of the Scripps Carbon Dioxide Program. And he's also professor and principal investigator of the Atmospheric Oxygen Research Group here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And I could go on and on about his achievements, but I think I will not waste any more time. But I just want to say I don't think there's anyone on the planet who is better positioned to give tonight's talk than Ralph Keeling. And so without further ado, I'm going to ask him to talk about understanding atmospheric oxygen, the other half of the global carbon dioxide story. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you all for coming on this day when you could have relaxed through the entire day and stayed home. So I appreciate everyone coming out. I thought I'd start by acknowledging that it's Veterans Day and that there's a time to reflect on service that people have dedicated to our country and to make a slight connection with the present talk to recognize that the problem of global warming, we hope, won't turn into a problem that moves into the dimensions of security, but I fear it might. So this is a topic that might have a connection with veterans in the future, I'm afraid. Now, the title says I'm going to talk about the other half of the global carbon dioxide story, but I can't help but start a little bit with the first half of the story. So my story really starts with my father's career. He did a PhD at the University of Illinois in polymer chemistry. This was in the 1950s, and the future was plastics. Now, I think his upbringing included excursions from the Chicago area to the west. He spent time in Estes Park exploring the Rocky Mountains, and when he was old enough to travel on his own, he went out picking fruit in the Washington state and going weekends hiking in the Cascades. He liked the west, he liked the outdoors. When he finished graduate school in polymer chemistry, he decided that whatever he did, he was going to move further west. So he took a postdoc at Caltech without really any clear idea of what he was going to do, just that he was moving in the right direction to get there. Now, he was given a project to measure uranium in rocks. I think uranium was also in the future at that time, plastics in uranium. And that involved a lot of rock crushing in basements, and that wasn't very thrilling either, and it didn't let him take advantage of being in the West. So he picked up on a different project that was suggested, which was to study carbon dioxide in river water. There was some question as to what controlled the carbon dioxide level in rivers, and there was no particular reason for working on this other than just fundamentally understanding how rivers worked. And so he went off on trips, camping trips in a sense, to sample rivers. Now if you live in Pasadena, you find that there are not too many rivers around. So it involved driving north. He drove north to Big Sur and other rivers in California, looked at the river water carbon dioxide concentration, but there was a complication that he couldn't really understand adequately what the river water carbon dioxide levels were, unless he also understood what was happening in the surrounding atmosphere. So he began to make measurements of carbon dioxide in air. And shortly after that, the carbon dioxide measurements in air became more interesting than the river water. It turned out that river waters, he could understand them in some simple terms and lost interest in them very quickly. Not that they're trivial, but his interests move elsewhere. His early work involved, well, I should say that while he was probing the atmosphere, he often took his young wife along with him. This is my mother, and this is my older brother, Drew, who was old enough to be along on some of these trips. And I don't know whether this is one of those trips or not, but here he is doing quite well at age about 5 months or 4 months. Now, his sampling technique for the atmosphere involved a rather low-tech method. He had these glass spheres that he would evacuate in the lab, take out, and they would open a little tap on it, and it would suck the air in, close it off, and then he would take it back to the lab and analyze it for carbon dioxide concentration. Now, carbon dioxide is a condensable gas. Water is also in air and is also condensable. So the first thing he would do is he would freeze the water out at a cold enough temperature to do that, and then he would use a newly available fluid, liquid nitrogen, to freeze out the carbon dioxide. And by carefully measuring the amount of air and the amount of condensed carbon dioxide, he could get a measure of abundance that was considerably more precise than other measurements had been up until that time. And he discovered, and he explains that the reason he did this was nothing more than he was having fun. He was having fun building equipment. He was having fun going out on camping trips. So it wasn't particularly motivated by anything other than a kind of self-indulgence. He quickly discovered, though, that the prior notions of what was happening with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere seemed to be wrong or misleading. There was an impression from prior work going back 100 years or more that carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere were highly variable, depending on place and time. You could get concentrations down to 200 parts per million, up to 500 parts per million. It was a messy system, highly variable. What he found, however, is that if he took samples in the afternoon, he was mostly sampling the air in woods, by the way, because that's where the streams were, he found that he got almost exactly the same concentration every afternoon, a concentration of around 310 parts per million. And he started to think that there might be a reason for this, that there might be something regular about the atmosphere above that, above the, away from the trees and away from the plants, the atmosphere might have some kind of stable, well-mixed background level. And he started probing that. He collaborated with a colleague named Rakestraw at Scripps to get samples from ships. He went up on the White Mountains in eastern California to get way, way above the Earth. And indeed, he found consistently stable levels of carbon dioxide. Now, at this time, there was an effort to spin up a large measurement program to study the Earth called the International Geophysical Year. And among the organizers of that were Roger Revelle at Scripps. There was a fellow named Harry Wexler at the Weather Service. Other notables included, I think it's Harald Rossby, a Swede. And my father's carbon dioxide measurements were of interest to this group because among the things they were interested in doing in the IGY was to start to do better measurements of carbon dioxide. Now, my father went and talked with Harry Wexler of the Weather Service. This is in Washington, D.C. And Wexler offered him a job. Now, Wexler had an idea that it would be nice to set up a station on the mountain of on Mauna Loa and track carbon dioxide levels accurately using some of the methods my father had developed. Now, this was a sound offer in many respects for my father to go back and work for Wexler, except for one problem. It entailed moving back east. Now, Roger Revelle also was aware of my father's work and put in a better offer. And so he ended up coming to Scripps, and I think I know why. So there was some discussion, however, that went on about how to do the measurements. And actually, there was not exactly a uniform of view between Wexler and Revelle as to how to do these measurements. Revelle was interested in a program that used ships and airplanes. That was, I think, the main thrust of his IGY investigations. And he wasn't too keen on my father spending a lot of time doing measurements repetitively on a mountaintop in the middle of Hawaii, which he was convinced wouldn't tell you very much. He was evidently not impressed with my father's earlier work showing that there was a stable background. My father was interested in probing that background and felt the best way to do that was to go to as far away a site as you could, like Mauna Loa. Well, the data, after a few years, essentially answered the discussion. and showing that there was a regular pattern in carbon dioxide indeed that showed up. So within a year or two, my father had detected a regular cycle, which my father recognized as almost certainly being due to the seasonal growing of land plants and the decay in the fall and winter of CO2 being released back to the atmosphere. Essentially, you were seeing the Earth or the biota of the Earth breathing. And he could also see that the levels were rising over time. Now, this record was inspirational to a lot of people. It really stands out as one of the main achievements of the 60s in the arena of environmental science as being the first evidence of a human impact on the planet as a whole. At the time, it was not as well recognized as the Rachel Carlson's Silent Spring and so forth, so it's really only in hindsight that we look at it in that way. It was known to a few people, but it was very influential among that crowd. And among the things that it did, it was shown in the White House. There were discussions about what this might mean in the distant future. But I think its most important impact on science immediately was to inspire a cadre of atmospheric scientists to look carefully at the question of whether carbon dioxide rising might have influenced climate. And Suki Manabe, Jim Hansen, Arakawa, a number of people got into the act of trying to understand exactly what rising carbon dioxide would do to climate. And they were using models of increasing sophistication, looking at the radiative effects of carbon dioxide. There were major questions as to how big the effect would be, and the questions revolved around things like how much the water vapor would increase along with the carbon dioxide, because that is an amplifier, whether the clouds would offer some compensation. But by the late 1970s, the community that had worked on this now for more than a decade had come to essentially a consensus, and this was reflected in the so-called Charney Report, a report that was commissioned by the National Academy of Sciences and included a number of notable scientists, including Charney, who was one of the founders of numerical weather forecasting. And they concluded that for a doubling of carbon dioxide, the world should warm something like 1.5 to 4.5 degrees C. Considerable range in that estimate because of uncertainties in the modeling, but nothing like zero seemed to be allowed by what they understood. This occurred at the same time additional information was coming in on other greenhouse gases. There was now evidence from by the late 1970s that methane was also on the rise, nitrous oxide was on the rise. Methane comes from rice paddies and cattle and landfills. Nitrous oxide is a byproduct of applying fertilizer to soil. It also comes naturally from soils. And the chlorofluorocarbons, the so-called freons, were also building up in the atmosphere. These also have a greenhouse effect, not as big as that of the rise in carbon dioxide, but enough to add up to a significant additional warming. It was recognized that the extent to which you would have an effect on climate would be counteracted by the tendency for combustion processes to produce haze, and the haze would filter the sunlight and produce less direct heating of the ground and thereby causing a counteracting cooling. Depending upon the extent to which the planet was getting hazier, that might have counteracted some of the warming. And it was also recognized that the oceans would play an important role in this problem. And in part because the oceans have an enormous capacity for absorbing heat. And just like it takes a while to cook a turkey in the oven because it takes a while for all that water in the turkey to warm up, it takes a long time for the oceans to warm up in a warming climate, and it would drag down the temperature of the atmosphere, reducing the warming you'd experienced. And largely because of this heat lag of the ocean, the Charney Report went on to say that we may not be given a warning until the CO2 loading is such that an appreciable climate change is inevitable. The concern was that because there was so much inertia in the system, by the time you actually saw the warming, it would be too late to actually stop it from being very serious. So in the 1970s, here's what the temperature record actually looked like. This is at the time of the Charney Report. Temperatures had stayed largely flat in the 19th century. They'd been warming in the early 20th century up to a peak in the early 1940s, late 1930s, and then there'd been a little decrease and then more or less level. This is not the pattern you would have expected from global warming. And this was not viewed as a contradiction because people recognized that climate does fluctuate naturally. And so it was a matter of time of waiting for the signal of global warming to overwhelm the natural variability before you'd actually see the signal. And what happened in the meantime is this. The all-time temperature record back to the recorded start in the mid-19th century. It was broken in 83. It was broken again in 87, 90, 95, 97, 98. And this record is actually 2 years out of date. 95 records, by some estimates, top the large record of the El Nino in 98, or at least are comparable to it in some other accounts. So we're on a steady warming trend. Now, this is essentially what was predicted by the Charney Report and is now taken as pretty solid evidence of a global warming effect having kicked in. And it's important to recognize that this was predicted before it happened. If you were in the business of forecasting stock markets and you said, well, after all this little blip here was going to be a run-up, you would gain some credibility for that. Now, other things have happened while accompanying the warming. Mountain glaciers are in retreat. Spring is arriving sooner. That's reflected, I should point out, in the oscillations in carbon dioxide getting larger with time, something I didn't point out in the earlier slide, but it is evident. Sea level is rising at an accelerating rate. It rose about 10 to 20 centimeters over the last century. The recent rise rate is more like around 30 per year, and this is forecast to continue to accelerate in the century ahead. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on climate impacts in this talk, but I want to just touch on them. And this is the one thing I want to highlight. Dramatic changes have occurred in Arctic sea ice. This is a result just from this last summer. The Arctic sea ice grows in the wintertime, of course, to encompass an area all the way down into Hudson Bay and essentially filling up the whole Arctic. But then in the summertime, it melts back. And the extent to which it melts back has been increasing year by year. And the average from 1979 to year 2000 for the minimum Arctic sea ice is outlined in purple here. And in September 2007, we hit a new all-time low of 4.1 million square kilometers. The norm is something like 6.5, so it's dropped dramatically. The last record, which was in 2005, was something like 5.2. So it looks like something really strange is going on with Arctic sea ice. This is something to watch. I mean, if this bounces back, in the next few years, it's going to decrease at a slowing rate. But what's happening right now is suggestive of something running away on us. So keep looking at this story, because this could get very interesting. At the time I got interested in this, I was in college, and so my first awareness of the Mauna Loa record really came in the 1970s. Now, I was aware my father worked at Scripps. I was aware he was working on something involving the atmosphere, but it was viewed as an awkwardness that he was studying the air while being at an oceanographic institution. So at the time I was in grade school, the story was something like, well, he studies the air over the water, and so that legitimized what he was doing. So I didn't have that great a grasp of it. But at some point when I was in college and had enough knowledge of the science myself, I got an appreciation for it, and this is more or less what the record looked like at that time. And what's happened since then, of course, is this. It's just rocketed up and up and up and up and up. Now, in the 1970s already, my father and other scientists were looking at the question of what was actually exactly causing this rise. Was it caused by fossil fuel burning? Was something else involved? And so there were questions that revolved around that, because understanding this rate of rise is essential to understanding how fast and how hard the system's being driven. Now, one thing that was clear already from the first few years of measurements is that the rate of rise of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was actually slower than the rate would have been if all the emissions from fossil fuel burning stayed in the atmosphere. Now, how do we know what's burnt in fossil fuel? Well, these are industrial records. Fossil fuel is a valuable commodity, so it has to be subject to fairly rigorous accounting. Some countries may be fudging their numbers a little bit, but these numbers for the rate of rise are viewed to being good to better than 10%. And what you see for the atmospheric rise is a rate of rise that's considerably slower than fossil fuel burning. So, to the extent that other processes in the Earth are affecting this, they're compensating for the rise. They're buffering the system. They're slowing the rise as opposed to causing it. We have more than enough carbon coming into the system to account for it. In fact, we have too much. What we have to account for is where the other carbon dioxide that didn't end up in the atmosphere has gone. Now, it's an interesting fact that if you scale this curve by multiplying by 57%, so you have a curve that rises 57% as fast, you line up almost perfectly with the data over the whole record. Why this works so well is a little bit of a puzzle to us, and we're trying to figure that out now, and I won't get into the details of it, but it does help emphasize the fact that what we're seeing here looks like a system that's being driven by fossil fuel burning with some buffering going on, accounting for carbon dioxide going elsewhere. Now, where could that carbon dioxide be going that isn't in the atmosphere? Well, there's really two possibilities that loom. One is that could it be absorbed by the oceans? The planet is 70% oceans, and the atmosphere is in good contact with the ocean. And the other is that it could be going into land plants. And that's really sketched in this simple cartoon here. This is showing the atmosphere. This is the ocean. This is representing the humanity's entire contribution through industry. And this is the whole terrestrial biosphere over here. Okay, and so we're emitting CO2 into the atmosphere. It's rising in the atmosphere. Here's the Mauna Loa records. But it's not rising as fast as we're stuffing it into the atmosphere because it's being taken up, perhaps, by the ocean and perhaps by the land. Now, why would the oceans take up carbon dioxide? Well, the ocean's seawater, that is an alkaline solution. It has alkalinity. It's basic. CO2 is an acidic gas in the sense that when it dissolves in water, it forms carbonic acid. And you get a little acid-base reaction going, which I've sketched out here, which basically reacts the CO2 with the relevant source of alkalinity here, carbonate, and makes baking soda, which is what this is. So the ocean has a chemical capacity for absorbing carbon dioxide by virtue of being alkaline. And it's in good contact with the atmosphere by virtue of its large surface area. Now, not all of the ocean, however, is at the surface. A lot of it's down at great depth, and that deep water doesn't make rapid contact with the atmosphere. The ocean turns over rather sluggishly. So the rate at which the ocean would absorb carbon dioxide would hinge in large measure of how fast those surface waters are brought up in contact with the atmosphere and allow the excess to come out. Another way to look at this is that the system between the ocean and the atmosphere initially was in some kind of equilibrium, which has been perturbed by this rise, and the system is responding to this disequilibrium by trying to establish a new equilibrium. And the way it's doing that is by the ocean absorbing carbon dioxide to try to come back into equilibrium, but it can't get there because we keep adding more to the atmosphere, so the ocean keeps taking it up. So it's kind of a race going on where the ocean keeps absorbing. It's just acting like a sponge, in effect. You can think of this as a kind of a sponge that's soaking up excess. So that's reasonably straightforward chemistry. The physics of the mixing is a little complicated. So this is not a quantity the rate of uptake is not something that we know from first principles that well. But we can get a rough handle on by making estimates. Now, the land is a little more subtle. Trees, of course, take up carbon dioxide. They photosynthesize. Photosynthesis takes up CO2. But it's not true that forests necessarily take up carbon dioxide. And I want to make that clear by this next sequence. So this is showing basically the first half of a life cycle of a plant, say a tree. It starts off with a seed in bare ground. Little seedling here, it's growing, it's taking up carbon dioxide. Where's that carbon dioxide going? It's going in to the plant. It's turning into carbon that's part of the plant. So the reason the carbon dioxide is being taken out of the atmosphere is that there's carbon in the plant itself. The tree grows, it's got more carbon in it. So there's continued uptake from the atmosphere until finally you have a larger tree, and this whole process involves uptake of carbon from the atmosphere. But of course, that's not the whole life cycle of a tree. Because at some point, some pest comes along and challenges it and maybe causes it to pass away, it falls over, it decays. And during this process, the carbon that's in the plant decomposes by termites or bacteria and is released back into carbon dioxide to the point where you have bare ground left over. And the net effect on carbon dioxide is nothing. It took it up, it let it back go again. So the life cycle as a whole doesn't do anything to atmospheric carbon dioxide. And in a forest, which has all stages of this life cycle represented, you presumably therefore have a very near balance between regions that are taking up carbon dioxide and other regions where there are plants decaying that are releasing carbon dioxide. So a mature forest will be in a kind of steady state where there's carbon dioxide exchange but no net uptake. That's a very important point because people think of the land as being something that will scrub the atmosphere of carbon dioxide. It won't do that just by being what it is. Now, it is possible for a forest to take up carbon dioxide as a whole, but it has to do that, in a sense, by greening, by actually accumulating more carbon, by somehow having a mismatch between these two rates. Now, that's not inconceivable that something like that has happened, because at the same time we've been burning fossil fuels, we've been releasing nitrogen to the environment. Nitrogen is a fertilizer. There's nitrogen coming into the system because it's a byproduct of combustion. Actually, it's the source of acid rain that we've all heard about, one of the main sources. Nitric acid can damage ecosystems, but in trace amounts, it's actually a fertilizer, and it can make things grow faster. Carbon dioxide also is a kind of aerial fertilizer. Plants tend to grow faster, not all plants, but plants grow a little faster if you give them more carbon dioxide. The plant has this challenging process that it has to undergo of getting the carbon dioxide into its leaf without letting the water out. If it lets all the water out, it desiccates. So it has these little holes called stomata that they're designed to just regulate that process. And if you give it more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it can get away with smaller stomata, thereby losing less water and therefore having a more favorable water balance and perhaps growing faster. So it's possible that by human activities on the planet, we might have caused ecosystems to actually green up. There's speculation and some evidence that that's going on. So I'm going to get to that shortly. Now, in the 1970s, remember this is when I got into this field, there was already a reasonable stab at accounting for the sources and sinks of carbon dioxide. There was something like 5.2 billion tons of carbon per year being released from fossil fuel burning. The measured atmospheric increase was 57% of that. Remember that slide that showed the 57%? That's just now being shown as a bar here. And oceanographers, looking at how fast the ocean mixed and taking account of the chemistry of seawater, had estimated the oceans were taking just about enough to account for the total fossil fuel burning. Except that maybe there was a little bit missing. In order to balance the budget off, you'd have to have a little bit of land uptake. That way that what was released from fossil fuel burning and not ending up in the atmosphere was accounted for as going somewhere, either into the ocean or the land. Now, this is a fairly tidy budget. There wasn't too much controversy for it for a few years, until a paper was published in Science magazine in 1978 that really was a kind of a wake-up call. Now, the most significant thing about this paper, in a sense, is that it represented the entry of a new community of scientists into this field. These people were terrestrial ecologists, and the people who put together that other budget were oceanographers and atmospheric scientists. So we had a sort of clash of cultures here. And what the ecologists called attention to was the fact that humans were probably causing considerable releases of carbon dioxide from land simply by the clearing of forested land for agriculture. If you have a forest, you have a lot of carbon. If you clear the trees out, you burn them away, however you clear it, you decompose them, the soil decomposes some, you till the land. Once you get to that state, there's less carbon per hectare, and that carbon would have been released to the atmosphere in the process of that. And they did a rough stab at what they thought should be happening from that. And so they came up with a rather different look at the budget. So here's the oceanographer's budget again. And here's what the ecologist said was going on. We have this release from fossil fuel burning, and then we have this all additional release of the same order of magnitude from land use. And here's what's going in the atmosphere. And you oceanographers, you'd be damned, in a sense, because what they're saying was something's wrong, because this didn't add up very well. But they viewed that as not being their problem, in a sense. They got their half right. Now the oceanographers could go figure out their half. Now the oceanographers, particularly Wally Broker, a kind of a notable in our community, still active, came back pretty hard and said, no, this can't be right. What they're calling for is this huge missing sink. Somewhere there has to be a sink for carbon that's unaccounted for. Now, the issue stayed like that for a few years, but there was a little bit of backing off on the part of the ecologists. And a few years later, the estimates from the ecologists had come down to a level that made it look about like this. So it wasn't quite as far out of whack, but it was still pretty bad. So the question was, what was needed to balance this budget out? It matters, because if you don't know where the carbon dioxide's going, you're not in a position to forecast what's going to happen in the future if you add more CO2 to the atmosphere. So identifying this missing sink and clarifying what it is was an important research challenge. In a sense, there are two possibilities. They're the same two possibilities. It could be that ecosystems outside of the impact of land use are absorbing carbon dioxide. compensating for the land use somehow, or slightly overcompensating as it's drawn here. Or the oceanographers got it wrong. The oceans are taking up more carbon. Now, the obvious way to get a handle on that would be to look hard at the oceans to see if there was evidence for more carbon accumulating, or look at land ecosystems outside of human impacts to see where they were greening up. Now, that's a little bit tricky because the oceans are big and they're variable, and ecosystems are big and variable. So actually, to stage a survey where you go out and actually keep track of what's going on in here is a pretty challenging task. And where I come into this is to look at a way of getting at this by looking at the air itself. Because there's a way to distinguish these two cases by just looking at the atmosphere, and that brings in atmospheric oxygen. Now, the idea of measuring changes in atmospheric oxygen wasn't mine. I got the idea from my father, and I don't even know where he got it from. It might have been his idea. But I was sitting around the table in our house in the late 70s, and my father was explaining all this to me. It was the first time I was absorbing this. And he said, what you really want to do is measure atmospheric oxygen, because that allows you to solve this problem. Now, to understand oxygen, we go back to this figure here, showing the cartoon of the carbon cycle, fossil fuel burning, land uptake perhaps, ocean uptake. And all we want to do now is put oxygen on this diagram. Now, when you burn fuel, you use up oxygen. If a tree grows by photosynthesis, it makes oxygen. So for both of these processes, there are corresponding and well-defined compensating fluxes of oxygen. Flux in the opposite direction. Uptake by fuel burning, release by photosynthesis. By the way, land use, which involves burning of land, would involve an emission like fossil fuel burning. The key here is that ocean uptake proceeds by and large by acid-base chemistry that doesn't involve oxygen. So by measuring the change in oxygen, we get a way to distinguish between whether this is going on or that is going on, because the one affects oxygen and the other doesn't. So to go back to this diagram here, there's oxygen loss associated with fossil fuel burning. There's oxygen loss associated with land use. There's no oxygen source or sink over here. So if the oceans were accounting for the sink, we would have a rather large loss of oxygen associated with these two processes. If there were compensating land uptake, there would be an additional source of oxygen. So the rate of oxygen loss would be different depending on these two cases. So the challenge with oxygen, and the reason it hadn't been done prior to this, has to do with the numbers. So first I'm going to review a little bit of the numbers for carbon dioxide. And this is a diagram where the area shown here, the area of the circle, represents an amount. So this is showing how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, a circle that big. And that's roughly how much we're releasing to the atmosphere every 10 years. Something like a little less than 10%. Doesn't all stay there. So we're making a pretty significant perturbation to carbon dioxide, and that's reflected, for example, in the Mauna Loa record. Now, carbon dioxide is a trace gas, 300 parts per million, or 380 parts per million. That's 380 molecules out of a million molecules in the air. Oxygen is 21% of the atmosphere or so. So out of a million molecules, there are 210,000 of them are oxygen. Now, 10 years of fossil fuel burning will affect atmospheric oxygen by taking out, can barely see this, a little chunk about as big as that circle out of the oxygen supply. Something like a part in 5,000 of the oxygen supply in the atmosphere is removed every 10 years by fossil fuel burning. You need a very precise measurement to actually measure this change. Now, by way of reference here, I'm also going to show another quantity here. This is the resource base estimated for fossil fuels. This is not exactly the reserves that are economically viable reserves at the moment. It's reserves that are viewed as being economically viable as you go through a depletion and the price rises. So there's enough fossil fuel out there to really swamp out the atmosphere. This is why we have a problem with carbon dioxide, because there's so much fossil fuel compared to how much CO2 is in the air. If we go through all that, we're overwhelming the system with extra carbon. But the reason I'm showing this now is to point out that the amount of fossil fuel, I should say that the amount of oxygen you would lose by burning this fossil fuel in the same diagram is a circle of about the same size. So you only lose about 1% of the oxygen in the atmosphere when you burn all the fossil fuel. So we don't have a crisis with oxygen depletion. even after we go all through all this, and we hope we don't, I think, we will only have lost 1% of the oxygen supply in the atmosphere. So we have a crisis with carbon dioxide. The interest in oxygen is not because it's an environmental problem, because it's diagnostic of what's controlling the carbon dioxide growth. So in graduate school, I worked on this interferometric method. I won't say much about it, except that in brief, it looks at changes in effect in the speed of light in an air sample, something you can measure extremely accurately. So I took the technology for measuring the speed of light and applied it to the atmosphere composition, and was able to develop a program based on this. It had the virtue of almost certainly succeeding at some scale, because this instrument could be made as big as I needed to get it as precise as I wanted it. At some point, I would have priced out the funding agencies, I think. But fortunately, I was able. This is the human scale. This is, if you can see this, this is a table right here. So a human being would be about this tall here. And after I was in graduate school, I came out to Scripps for a while. Then I went to NCAR, and I developed a program to track changes in oxygen. Here's the stations where I'm sending flasks to have the air sampled and oxygen concentrations analyzed. Some of these stations are pretty nice places. My two favorites, this is Palmer Station. A fellow in my group, Adam Cox, was just down there, took this photo. Pretty remote place. Again, we're trying to get away from influences of trees and people, because you get a more representative sample that way. Another place I like, this is Cold Bay, Alaska. I'm not going to show too many slides here. And here's what the data show. This is from a station in Tasmania, Cape Grim. Oxygen is decreasing over time. This is now something like a 16-year record or so. And don't worry too much about the units here. Zero is essentially the level in about 1985. And 100 of these is 100 out of a million oxygen molecules lost. We're measuring a trend over time. This is a rather small trend. As I said, we don't expect it to be decreasing very fast, but it's plotted in a way that highlights the fact that it's decreasing. The zero oxygen level on this plot would be somewhere like several miles below the floor here. Okay, that's roughly how this would scale if we're on an absolute scale. Now, the interesting thing is to compare this to the rate of loss you expect from fossil fuel burning. And like carbon dioxide, what you see is that the trend we observe is smaller than the trend you predict from fossil fuel burning. But in this case, it's much closer. In fact, you only have to scale this by 85% to get it to match up. This makes sense, because one of the things that's buffering carbon dioxide is uptake by the oceans. And that's not affecting oxygen, remember? So you don't expect it to be buffered. But the fact that it's buffered at all is interesting, because it says that somehow, in spite of what we're doing to the planet is able to compensate by producing more oxygen by gaining biomass. Somehow the planet has to be gaining biomass in order to produce oxygen to offset fossil fuel burning. So there's new information in this that pertains to carbon budgets. Just to show you that this trend is representative, here's the same 85% of fossil fuel scaled against the station data from Ellesmere Island in the Arctic. Here's the data from Mauna Loa itself. By the way, there's a cyclone oxygen that mirrors, to some extent, the cyclone carbon dioxide. I won't say much about that. There's new information in that as well, having to do with the oceans. But our focus today is really on this rate of decrease. So going back to this budget, you can now, on the basis of oxygen, say where the split would be between the green and the blue on this plot. So this is now an oxygen-based carbon budget for 1993 to 2003. And this is with the recent estimates of land use change. And you see that it's essentially where we were before. The oceanographers more or less had it right in the 1970s. The oceans were taking up slightly less than half of what's being burned out from fossil fuel burning. And if there's this large land use source, then there has to be some kind of considerable compensation by land biota. So remember, what we're seeing in oxygen is in a sense, the difference between this orange and the green. And that establishes where the split has to be. So we're only seeing a small compensation, but that's because we're compensating also for the land use part. Now, I personally am of the opinion that the land use estimates may still be overestimated. So my best guess as to what the budget really looks like is something like this. And I think I point this out because there's considerable slop still in how much carbon dioxide is being released by land use emissions. And if you assume they're overestimated, you get a budget like this. This looks more reasonable to me. The oceans are the main sink. There's a small compensating sink on land. And then there's a smaller emission from land use change. This is pure speculation, really. But I, from my standpoint, from one reason I suggest this is that the very close link between the fossil fuel burning and the rate of rise, to my mind, suggests that the main thing driving this is fossil fuel burning. And I'm a little bothered by some other component as big as that being on the driving side of this. Now, this allows you to say some things right away about the system. For example, looking at this diagram, what would happen to carbon dioxide if we completely stop fossil fuel burning? Well, these sinks would presumably continue for a while, the green and the blue, so that the atmospheric levels would be dropping by that rate if there was land use a little bit less. So carbon dioxide levels would start dropping right away at a rate that's probably more or less comparable to the present rate of rise. So if we stopped all fossil fuel burning, atmospheric CO2 would start down at about the rate it went up. The Mauna Loa would look like a little volcano like this. The record would go up and then down again. You can also ask, how much do we have to cut fossil fuel burning to stop the rate of rise? So it would go up and then plateau. Well, you'd have to cut out the 57% that's staying in the atmosphere. So you'd have to cut fossil fuel burning by 57% to get the level to stabilize. So it gives you a sense of how hard it is to actually stop this thing, because to actually stop it requires a really drastic change in our present habits and our use of fossil fuel. Now I'm going to broaden the perspective here and show how the Mauna Loa CO2 record looks in the context of the reconstructed carbon dioxide levels going into the distant past, which is possible by capturing air that's been captured in polar ice cores. And here's the present level. And here's the concentration over the last 400-some thousand years. And you see a cycle here that reflects the glacial, interglacial cycle as the Earth has gone in and out of ice ages. At these lower levels here, the Earth was in an ice age. At the upper levels, it was in a so-called interglacial. We were in an interglacial, the so-called Holocene, for about the last 10,000 years or so, where carbon dioxide varied between about 270 and or 260 and 275 parts per million. And then it shot up. The very end of the record. The Mauna Loa record on this is condensed into a vertical line. Okay, so there's the Mauna Loa record, but we basically, in order to get that to 400,000 years, we had to scrunch the record up to the point where it's just a vertical line. So in fact, the Mauna Loa record started not too high above the Holocene background, as is now clear from this. It shows you how much we're perturbing the system already. Now what's interesting, especially, is to look what would happen if we stay with a business-as-usual type fossil fuel burning scenario, where we go through all the reserve with a kind of logistic function over some number of centuries. We let the growth, if we didn't have any environmental concerns about it, presumably that's what would happen. We'd keep burning the fuel, it would accelerate it up until we reach some point where there's a shortage, and then it would slowly come back down in a kind of bell-shaped curve over some centuries. So what I'm going to show you is a scenario looking into the future that takes that assumption of a fuel burning scenario. But in order to show this, I have a little problem, and that is that the scale is way off. So I have to scrunch this down. So I'm going to scrunch it down. By the way, this is where Al Gore is going up in the elevator. Okay, this is my version of that. Scrunch it down again. Scrunch it down again. So finally we got the peak. So if we go through a business as usual type scenario with the present growth rates, carbon dioxide levels will peak out somewhere around 1,500 parts per million. This shouldn't surprise you from what I showed you earlier about the size of the atmospheric reservoir and the size of the fossil fuel reserve. We're capable of increasing what's in the atmosphere many, many times if we go through this reserve, and that's what this is doing. It's compensated to some extent by the sinks. This is a calculation that takes those into account. Now, this time axis doesn't show you much detail about the present, so I'm going to expand this region right here. So notice that this excess carbon dioxide lasts for tens of thousands of years. We're perturbing the system for tens of thousands of years into the future. If you went a similar amount of time in the past, you'd be getting into the Neanderthals, practically. Okay, so this is it's beyond biblical. Okay. Span it again. Here you see that this peak here, which looked like a very sharp peak, is itself not trivial in length. Okay, here I finally blow it up where you can see it. So this peak rising up and coming down is spread over essentially 500 years or so. Now, I think we want to try pretty hard not to let this happen. I mean, it's clear that we're already seeing effects of climate change at the 2007 level of carbon dioxide. We're seeing Arctic ice melting back. We're seeing glaciers retreating. We're seeing all these things happening. And we're not even seeing the full effects of the CO2 emission because of the thermal inertia of the ocean, which is holding back the response. So we're only seeing the very beginnings of what will turn into almost certainly an unbelievably massive change in our planet if we let this happen. So what people are talking about as a more hopeful future is to get to some kind of scenario where we stabilize the level. We still let it rise some because it's too hard to turn it around, at a level somewhere between, say, 450 and 500 parts per million. A scenario like that, if you actually looked at it on the scale of the Mauna Loa record, would look something like this. Here's business as usual, and here's what the Mauna Loa record would have to look like if we go into stabilization scenario. The Mauna Loa record changes its shape. Our problem, in a sense, is that the Mauna Loa record has the wrong shape. And what we need to do is we need to bend this curve. Okay, that's the challenge. Now, it's tough to bend it. And what this shows is what's actually required in terms of future emissions to go from this yellow scenario, which is this is showing CO2 emissions here, this is time going forward, here's the historic emissions, and here's what the business as usual scenario assumed, rising up like this. But to get it to bend over like this, we have to almost immediately stop the growth in fossil fuel burning and then cut back such that we're mid-century, we're at something like 30% of the present levels, and then it has to slowly decrease after that. It can't go up again, it has to keep going down. And I will point out that this is what the whole planet has to do. So countries that are burning more than their fair share already will have to cut more. That's us. So we would have to cut more than 30%, down to 30% by the middle of this century. So that's what people are hoping to do. If we don't do that, something like that, we're back on this trajectory, okay? So that's the choice. That's the choice we face. Do we do this? Do we ride this huge wave? God knows what that will do. Or do we do something like this? So how can we do this? I mean, I'll go through this rather briefly because I don't intend to emphasize this. There is... No one approach is going to get us off fossil fuels to this extent. So we have to try different things and be inventive about it. But one of the obvious areas of low-hanging fruit is just energy efficiency. We need to figure out how to use the energy we have more efficiently so we need less. And from my standpoint, you know, looking over my lifetime, I see all sorts of things that have changed since I was a child that demand more energy. There's the fact that my children don't play on the streets. They play inside where they have to have games, and they have to be driven to their neighbor's house instead of walking there. Many of these things, and we now drive great big cars because we're so worried about auto safety, so which may be a valid concern. But many of these things that have changed in the last 50 years, I think, that involve using more energy, haven't really improved lifestyle. I think there's room for a lot of improvement in energy efficiency with almost no degradation in our present lifestyle, particularly in this country. We have to get off fossil fuels in the energy we use to a large degree. So we have to develop alternative energy, solar, wind, probably some more nuclear power, geothermal, other forms of harnessing biofuels. And probably we're going to keep burning fossil fuels at a rate that's too large to make this curve roll over. We're going to have to figure out how to change what a... Basically, we have to get rid of smokestacks so that instead of releasing the CO2 in the atmosphere, we capture the CO2 and we pump that CO2 down into some deep reservoir where it won't leak out. And there's a lot of work going on that, and it's not impossible to do that in almost almost for sure. So all these things are going to happen, and I think we need to take a kind of optimistic view of this and say, hey, we can do this. This will be fun. Right? And finally, I think we have to admit that as much as we do, we're not going to change the course of climate from changing to a significant degree that reshapes our planets. And I think the way to underscore that is to go back to this diagram here. These 450 and 550 stabilization levels are well outside the natural range. This is the best we can hope for, but it's well outside the natural range. It's interesting that if you look at reconstructed sea levels in the distant past, when the Earth was a few degrees warmer than today, and it was warmer for a long time, sea level was typically tens of meters, that is 30, 60 feet higher than today. So it sure looks like a planet that goes up to a temperature just a few degrees warmer, like this will probably do, will eventually see a sea level that's 30, 60 feet higher than today's sea level. That entails melting most of Greenland and probably most of the West Antarctic ice sheet. We may well be committing ourselves to that, even in the optimistic scenario. Now, this isn't necessarily alarming because we don't know, well, how fast Greenland and Antarctica will melt. We don't know for sure that they will, but I think it's a reasonable speculation. But we don't know how fast they would melt. And if it takes 1,000 years to melt them, a sea level rise of 30 feet over 1,000 years is probably not such a horrible thing to adapt to because it's so slow. But it could be a fast process. So we still may be at risk of some fairly catastrophic climate change, even in these stabilization scenarios. So we have to be prepared for that. And it's worth pointing out that the burden of adapting to climate change is going to be the heaviest in the developing world because these people live closer to the land. These are people who can't turn on the air conditioning. These are people who don't get their food by shopping at Henry's. They grow it themselves. And those people are very vulnerable to changes in climate. And the rest of the world has to start looking at that problem and trying to figure out a system where people can cope with this by allowing migration and all sorts of other adaptation strategies. That has to be part of the discussion. So finally, I want to point out that in this range of things that have to happen in the future, there's a role for continuing what we do right here at Scripps, which is continuing observations. Why do we want to, say, keep measuring carbon dioxide and oxygen? Well, for one thing, when I showed you this stabilization scenario, what we have to do to cut emissions, that made assumptions about how the sinks of carbon dioxide are going to evolve in the future. They're assumptions that are reasonable but not certain. And if we find out that something else is happening that changes the sinks, we might have to cut even more. Or maybe we'll get lucky and we'll find out we don't have to cut them less. We could cut them less. But there's considerable uncertainty in what the actual trajectory would need to be to produce stabilization at a particular level. So we have to continue to study what's happening with carbon dioxide. Now, what are we worried about? Well, let me just point out where some of the other carbon reservoirs stack up on this diagram. Here's the atmosphere. Here's the fossil fuel resource base I showed you earlier. Here's the total size of the reservoir of carbon in land plants. This is something that I don't think is typically appreciated, that the total amount of carbon in plants is less than what's in the atmosphere, and it's completely dwarfed by fossil fuel burning. There's no way we're going to grow trees to get out of this problem. We'd have to turn this whole planet into something that looks completely different than our present planet, having plants growing in ecosystems or climates where they couldn't possibly grow. We can help a little bit by growing plants, and that's worth doing, but we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that's much of an answer. But what are we worried about in looking forward? Well, there's more carbon in soils, quite a lot of carbon. Most of this carbon builds up very slowly over time. So these are not pools of carbon that we could likely increase with time by any reasonable method. And then here's a large pool of carbon in the ocean. But the oceans respond typically by buffering, so this is not necessarily vulnerable to release. What we're most worried about here are these soil reservoirs, particularly in cold regions where we know it's getting warmer now. The Arctic is warming up. There's a lot of carbon in peat deposits in the Arctic. As you warm the permafrost, the bogs will drain, exposing the peat to the air instead of water, and it's very likely will decompose faster. There's carbon stored in soils that are frozen. Again, when you thaw them, the bacteria will start chewing away faster. So there's really a concern that by warming the planet, we'll start releasing carbon from these reservoirs that'll go back into the atmosphere. It's not enough to dwarf the fossil fuel burning, but it's enough to considerably aggravate the problem. And if that happens, we'll have to cut even harder. So that's the kind of thing we're going to be tracking with these records over time. Finally, in a sense, the atmospheric records are the Earth's report card. And now here's a hopeful example. Here's trends in methyl chloroform in the atmosphere. This is a gas that was banned under the Montreal Protocol because of its potential to damage the ozone layer. And production came to a crashing halt in the early 1990s, and the levels didn't just plateau, they went down with time. This would get an A for a report card, okay? That's a nice shape. It's a better shape than we can possibly hope for carbon dioxide. As I said, what we want to do is just bend it over. So I think we could hope for a B minus. This would be a B minus if we can get it to do this. This is an F, okay? Right? So what we'll be doing over the next few decades is grading the planet. Do we get a B minus or do we get something a lower grade? So finally, I'll close here. This is a picture of my father taking one of his flasks. We don't have a shot of him as a young man doing that, unfortunately. This was shortly before he passed away. Still enjoying camping out, taking air samples. Here is Al Gore after a 20-second lesson, doing his best to take an air sample. Not quite demonstrating the proper technique, but we applaud his efforts. And finally, in closing, I need to acknowledge a lot of people who work with me. I don't have time to read through all these names, but I'm keeping track of quite a few people these days, including a number of students and postdocs. Jan Botsek happens to be here. This is my father. Another person who needs to be acknowledged, who was seen in one of the slides earlier, is my mother, who played an enormous role in shaping my career and really in enabling my father's career. And she's here somewhere, so thank you.